Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We are going to start today with a public hearing on House Bill 2740. Call Dr. Warner. We haven't seen you for a long time up here. Welcome back.
I've been in hiding, Madam Chair.
I know where you've been.
Until June 30th. Members of the committee, House Bill 2740 actually did not come to you through the House Revenue Committee. It came through the Sustainability and Economic Development Committee and straight to the floor. It deals with the Cultural Trust Development Board. It does make some adjustments to the governance of that board by adding some additional members. And it allows, extends the time period that the Arts Commission can use the Trust for Cultural Development license plates revenue for marketing to June 30th, 2019. Would add additional time period in which that can be done. Legislative Fiscal Office sees this as a shift from the other fund accounts within the Cultural Trust Development account to administration, which would be the marketing, and anticipates that there would be about $300,000 based on historical patterns for grants through the marketing efforts.
Okay, we have Chris Darcy signed up. Christina, you want to come up too?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Darcy. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust. I'm here representing the seven members of the Cultural Trust Board and the five culture partner agencies of the Cultural Trust to speak in support of House Bill 2740. The bill proposes to do three things. One, expand the size of the board from seven citizen members to 11 citizen members to increase the outreach and fundraising capacity of the Oregon Cultural Trust. Secondly, to continue the use of license plate revenues authorized in the February 2008 special session by passage of House Bill 3607 to market the Cultural Trust and increase outreach to all counties in Oregon. And three, clarify that the grants made by the Cultural Trust to county and tribal cultural coalitions will only be awarded to those coalitions that are operating under a cultural plan that has been approved by the Oregon Cultural Trust Board. Since its establishment by the legislature in 2001, the Cultural Trust has become a national model for integrated funding of the arts, humanities, heritage, and historic preservation. I ask for your support of the bill, and I would be pleased to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Did you want to add anything, Christina?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Christina McNitt. I represent the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, which is a trade group representing arts, heritage, and humanities across Oregon. House Bill 2740 was brought to you at our request through the Cultural Trust, and we are fully supportive of the bill and appreciate the hearing today.
Thank you. And to your knowledge, there is no opposition to this?
Madam
that
Chair,
is correct.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Anybody else want to talk? Okay. Close the public hearing.
Open a
work session on House Bill 2740.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2740 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Hess will carry this bill.
Well,
if she doesn't get here, Senator Rosenbaum will carry the next one. If they can get out of committee. Okay, now we will open. If you could get, maybe somebody could go fetch Representative Reed. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3082.
Chris.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3082 creates a pilot project within the Department of Revenue that would require occupational licensees to demonstrate tax compliance with personal income tax laws, corporate, or tobacco tax laws. It allows any state agency, board, or commission to participate in the project, but limits the number that may participate to three. And it would allow the Department of Revenue to disclose to the agencies whether or not a taxpayer is in compliance. And for purposes of this project, it defines compliance, and there are four criteria that would go into that definition. And basically, the Department of Revenue would say yes or no as to whether or not the licensees were in compliance. And it requires the department to report to the legislature no later than January 31st of 2011 and repeals the pilot project on January 2nd, 2016. And you do have in your packet a fiscal impact statement and a revenue impact statement. So you have all the paperwork for the bill.
Okay. Can you just go briefly, the revenue impact I see is minimal, but can you go over the fiscal, if there's any fiscal?
The fiscal is considered minimal. The expected cost is about $36,000 and a half FTE spread among four positions within the department during the 2009-11 biennium. Kind of the bottom line for the cost.
Okay, but this doesn't have a subsequent to Ways and Means?
No.
Oh, it does too.
It does.
Oh, I see. No, I guess it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Chris, does it include costs to the regulatory agencies that have to work with the department in developing these pilots, like Board of Accountancy or whomever we're using here, tax practitioners and...
I don't know. It doesn't include those, and it addresses that issue. But because the three agencies aren't specifically identified, the costs are not included.
I just noticed something. I just received a note. We've got we apparently do have a subsequent to Ways and Means on this other bill.
Oh, on 2740.
Yeah. I'm going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill, on House Bill 3082, and reopen the work session on House Bill 2740. And I don't see a reason for a referral. So what I'd like to do is, do you see a reason for a referral on this call?
Fiscal statement.
Yeah, it's no. I don't see. Wait a second. There's, yeah, minimal expenditure impact. So what I'd like to do is maybe look for a... Go ahead.
You should have a statement.
I do. This one? Okay, why don't we deal with this and then we'll wait for... there's Representative Reed. We ran into a road bump. Representative Reed, we're solving it here.
Why this would go to Ways and Means.
Yeah, I don't either. So I know.
Be saved.
Yeah, Chris, why don't you let Paul sit here and we'll get this straightened out. Apologies, audience. We'll get this straightened out in a second here.
You'll have to send the vote, but yeah, she put in the wrong fiscal.
She did?
Yeah, she put in 24/7. This is the fiscal.
Oh, okay. Senator Morris, I would like to move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which we passed House Bill 2740. Is there any discussion, objection, so ordered? What's next? Senator Morris, the bill is before us now, right?
Before the committee.
Senator Morris, would you give us a revised motion on this to refer it to the floor with a due pass recommendation after a prior subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent prior referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2740 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation with a prior subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Hash, you no longer have to carry this bill. Because that's what happens to people who are late to committee. They are assigned to carry bills.
Apologize, Madam Chair. Yes.
All right. We will reopen our public hearing on House Bill 3082 with my apologies to all. Somehow the wrong fiscal made its way into our files. We've had a summary of the bill from Chris, and we will now ask for testimony from Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed, state representative from District 27. It's an honor to be before at least three of your members who had such illustrious success over the weekend. We've heard some legendary stories already.
Go capital punishment.
We're just a little sore today.
So House Bill 3082 is the latest in a line of similar attempts. Those who have been here before me have undertaken similar efforts, but I think what you have before you is an approach that will work, that has had good participation in its development, and it's really an effort, I think, to be looked at from at least two perspectives. One is an effort to make sure that people are following the law, and the other is as an efficiency initiative. So it's a pilot project that would allow, as you've heard, three agencies to work with the Department of Revenue to make tax compliance a condition of receiving or renewing an occupational license. There are a few things that I think are important to make clear, and I did this when I carried it on the floor, that compliance is a pretty broad definition. We heard testimony in the House committee about how frequently and relatively easily the department creates and maintains payment plans, and how well they work with taxpayers who are communicating with the department. That's really what this effort is intended to motivate people to be communicating with the department. I think that's really important. And it also it's worth reiterating that no one gives up any rights to appeal. No one is going to be prevented from pursuing their career as a result of this. But it is, I think, an efficiency initiative because it allows the department to have to spend less money in pursuing money that's already owed. It's an important and significant issue. You probably are all as well aware of the tax gap as I am. There was a study, I think, from the Brookings Institution a couple of years ago, which estimated that gap, the difference between what is owed and what is paid, at 20% nationally. I'm hopeful that Oregonians are a little bit more honest than that. In fact, the Oregon Business Magazine a couple months ago suggested that in Oregon that's 18.5%, so perhaps we're a little bit ahead there. But in an era when we're looking at the horrible budgets that we're all having to confront, money that is already owed in taxes makes good sense, I think, to go after. It's a pilot project. Requires the department to come back and report to us on how well it works, at which time we can evaluate whether it needs to be changed or continued. And I'd commend it to your attention. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, and thank you for bringing us this bill. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
I will accept our use of the word compliance, although it goes against every grain of... But given that, what is the, and maybe Representative Reed, you're not aware, I don't know. What is the current penalty, statutory, in Oregon for non-compliance, not filing? I mean, the IRS can throw you in jail after 2 years of non-compliance, meaning not filing. Does Oregon have a statute on what the penalty is?
Why don't we wait for our next witness, who will be the Director of the Department of Revenue?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
I just want to say I compliment the sponsors here, the House, for bringing this. This feels like some of those bills we've already had before, 690, credit reporting, and amnesty. And if we want to be, get real with what we have to do to get people to pay what they owe, then I think these are the steps necessary. And this shouldn't threaten any of the other honest, licensees, so to speak, as long as they're doing what the law says they should do.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And basically, this people self-select if they want to participate in this program. So.
Right. Madam Chair, the Department of Revenue would work with agencies to select. And I think the intent is to find somewhat of a representative sample of the various kinds of licensing agencies. Some are very large, some are very small, different sorts of people who are licensed, so they could uncover some of the issues that ought to be addressed in determining how a program would best be operated.
And we, since we have our very own certified public accountant on this committee, we've had many discussions about compliance. And Senator Telfer, I thought his definition kind of matched yours.
I thought he said something about paying.
Madam Chair.
On a payment
compliance
plan.
Compliance has nothing to do with compliance.
On a payment plan, though.
Well, I've grown up with the compliance being filing. So that's okay.
I'll.
I'm the new kid on the block. I'll learn any new term you want.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we have worked through several amendments to try and craft something that works with the intent, and I am by no means an expert on that. I'm glad that the director is here who can probably respond more directly, but certainly the intent is to have it a broad sort of definition so that if people are making an effort, people are communicating with the department, that would constitute compliance, at least with respect to the intent here.
I think he hasn't been part of the conversation.
So. Right. Which you may not cry into your beer about. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Elizabeth Harchenko.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I've asked Deborah to join me so that for the technical questions we get good answers. I just wanted to urge you to give favorable consideration to this bill because, as we reported to you in January when we gave you the results of our compliance report, one of the practices that is growing around the country that was identified as something that we should seriously consider was looking at the licensing function as a place to encourage folks to assure that they are in compliance with our income tax laws. And when I testified on the bill in the House committee, I told a story that I heard when I was in the first 6 months of my service as director, so this has been about 12 years ago. I was going to a meeting with the Internal Revenue Service up in Seattle with what was then called the Pacific Northwest region, which included Hawaii. And the Hawaii director told me that within the last few months, he, together with the Internal Revenue Service manager in Honolulu, had worked with the real estate board to try to get a greater degree of compliance by realtors in that state. And they did an extensive public information campaign. They let licensed realtors know that about a year ahead of time that when their time for renewal of their license came up, they would need to be able to verify that they were filing their returns, their Hawaii returns, and their IRS, their federal returns as well, in order to be able to have their licenses renewed. And with a twinkle in his eye, the director said, and we got more new returns from realtors that year than I knew we even had people licensed. He said it was a tremendous, tremendous tool to use to assure that people who are not in our system in other ways, as employees particularly, are aware that they do need to comply, they do need to file and report and pay their taxes. As Representative Reed testified, the bill authorizes us to conduct a test, a pilot, a proof of concept, to find some willing licensing board partners so that we can design a system and test it in a way that will be transparent for licensees, so for those folks who are engaged in trades or professions that require licenses in Oregon who have filed and are in compliance. It's going to be completely transparent to them. They will go on with their business. For those who are not, we would be able to contact them and be working with them well before their renewal dates came up. So we're going to look for a little agency, a middle agency, and a larger agency to test this with and try to develop so that it'll be as simple and straightforward as possible. We're aware of the natural concerns about disclosure, and given the way that the bill defines compliance, we think that we'll be able to simply say yes or no to the agency and interact directly with the licensee if there is any issue that needs to be followed up on, and to manage that in a way that won't require disclosure of tax information outside the agency. We intend to report back. This was something that was in our business plan. I think there was a little bit of discussion about whether there was a fiscal on it. We had already intended, as a result of the compliance report, to look for a way to test this concept during this next biennium. So that's why it doesn't have a fiscal on it for us. And then I also wanted to let you know that in the last several months, the Secretary of State's office came in and said they wanted to do a performance audit with us on compliance issues, and this was one of the issues that we flagged as something that we wanted to investigate further. So they've done a little bit of work. They're not done yet, but they've done a little bit of work on just looking at a couple of different groups to help us evaluate the potential value of the tool, and we have a couple folks here from the Secretary of State's office who are able to tell you about where they are in that work. So with that, if there are questions, technical questions about the bill, I'm going to defer to Deborah.
Thank you. Do you currently have the ability to get lists of licensees and just determine whether they filed a tax return?
Madam Chair, we certainly, to the extent that lists of licensees are public records, we have the ability to ask agencies for lists of their licensees. And then the question is whether we've got a reasonable way of checking against our own records. One of the challenges that we're going to have to figure out how to manage is that some agencies collect numbers that are used for tax identification and some agencies do not. And so we're going to have to make sure that we've got a system in place that allows us to make sure we're matching up the correct people. The other issue that we're going to have to work our way through is that for some agencies you can get a license in the name of a business, doing business as, or an entity name, and so we're going to want to work through those issues as well. How do we deal with someone who's getting a license and they're able to get it through a limited liability entity name or a doing business name or something like that? So we've got a lot of the next level down issues that we want to work our way through, and that's why the pilot will be valuable to us.
So even if compliance were defined very narrowly, as Senator Telfer does, simply by virtue of having filed a return, you're in compliance. Even if with that narrow definition, it would move you farther forward than you are now?
Madam Chair, I think that one of the keys in the legislation is our ability to inform the business partner whether there is an issue with compliance, and for the business partner to be willing to say to the licensee, you need to clean that up. Right now, it's a situation where we have the ability to go and request information, get a list of licensees, and then to the extent we don't find matches, then we have to follow up with our own resources. This is kind of a preventive tool. It's one of the ways that encourages people to satisfy their statutory obligation by taking responsibility for being in compliance.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth or Deborah, either one of you. It says in the background here that a similar provision was dropped in the Senate last session because of the possibility of unintended consequences, such as a taxpayer being considered out of compliance through no fault of their own. And I do support this bill. In fact, I'm a sponsor. But how do you address that concern?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I think the concern last session...
Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As I recall the discussions last session, there was a question about whether or not someone who was on a pay plan or, well, that was it, primarily on an installment plan with us would be considered to be in compliance. And the changes that you see in the bill, page 2, lines 4 through 13, try to address that. So the point is that if someone, even if they owe tax, if they've contacted us, we set up a pay plan, they're current with the pay plan, we consider that to be in compliance.
Thank you. Senator Morris?
And this is a question that arises out of my lack of knowledge about what I'm going to ask.
That's never happened in this committee before. Yeah.
Well, I can demonstrate ignorance real quickly. Would this bill be required or deemed necessary if on all of the applications for the professions and license for the privilege of doing business in this state, a requirement to have a tax ID number with that license?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, even if that were on the application form and they were required to provide it, I don't believe there's anything that would authorize the agency not to issue a license if they were not in compliance, which is really what this bill does. It allows those agencies to say, in order to get a license in Oregon, you need to demonstrate you're in compliance. And that, I don't believe, is in current law, at least for some agencies.
Well, I guess as a follow-up to related is, it seems this bill assumes that you have known filers. And my guess is that in some categories you will have unknown filers. And that may be the most fertile ground, actually, of those that are not reporting but have a license. And I'm wondering how we would get at that issue as well. And it seems to me that if you had the ability to use the word data match with all of the licenses that we have in this state through a tax ID number, you could very quickly determine whether they, they could have some fictitious number that they enter for a tax ID that the licensing board wouldn't know whether it was valid or not, but if you had that information, you would quickly know. And it would also require them, if they had to have that tax ID number, it would seem that maybe I better be serious about my tax obligations.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, there are two complicating factors related to that. One is that for individuals, their tax identification number is their Social Security number.
Okay.
Under federal law, there are limits on the use that can be made of Social Security numbers and the right of even state government to demand that someone provide it. And so there might be some complication created by federal constraints around the use of Social Security numbers. The other issue that I see is the legislature 2 years ago or 4 years ago, I'm not sure which, but in a prior legislative session, set a high bar for state government in protecting information that, if gotten by people who were unscrupulous, could result in identity theft, and has imposed a high standard of protection on any agency that has that kind of information from anyone that does business with it. And I would be concerned about a licensing board that in the past had not had any need to ask for, especially a Social Security number, and not having the kinds of protections of their documentation, whether it's automated systems or paper systems, that then might be at risk of violation of that state statute that tries to protect confidentiality and privacy of that very sensitive information. So one of the reasons that we want to run this pilot is to see whether there are other ways to validate identity that don't require us to insist or require a licensing board to insist on a Social Security number and create that potential risk. There are ways that we can triangulate into identification that shouldn't require us to have to rely on a Social Security number. It's just one of those things that has gotten so sensitive now that I personally don't want to create that risk for a licensing board that doesn't need that number in order to keep track of their licensees.
Do we know? Oh, I mean, I can't imagine that a licensing board wouldn't ask for a Social Security number, since, I mean, confirming someone's actual identity is pretty key to licensing someone. Do you know the answer to that? Are there some that don't?
Madam Chair, I would say the majority of them do not.
Yeah, I think the Board of Accountancy does.
No, I know the State Bar does not. I know that, as I said, under federal law, you cannot insist on having someone provide a Social Security number unless there's an exception under federal law for insisting on that. Mm-hmm. And licensing for a trader profession isn't one of those exceptions. Now, I believe that one or two boards may have required Social Security numbers well into the past and have some sort of grandfathering protection, but not all of them do. And
you're confident that you have other ways of matching the identification?
Madam Chair, that's one of the things that we know that we will need to do, is to be able to validate identity without having to rely on very, very sensitive information that, if put together with a name and an address, could put somebody at risk, especially since most of those licensing agencies, their licensee lists are public records, mm-hmm. the addresses they provide, the business names they provide. You know, it's just, we're used to protecting that information because we have to protect tax information, and that information comes in on returns. But I would be very concerned about requiring agencies that haven't needed it to collect it. We certainly can, however, as we do the pilot, do some inquiry across the broader base of licensing agencies and see how many do and do not ask for a tax identification number, and then report back on sort of what are the issues that we come across in terms of validating identity of taxpayers. I just wouldn't want to recommend it at this point.
To follow up on your original question, and your response was that there are some filers that use a DBA. In the event that happens, and they do not then list the underlying principles in that DBA, why couldn't we require that? So that you would, in fact, of all these licensees, you would have the ability to match it to the person.
I think when you file an assumed business name, there is a registrant who mm-hmm. is filing for the assumed mm-hmm. business name. So that
would come back.
So that's listed by the Secretary of State. Actually, you can go online and find that out. Anybody can.
Because they're registered. Mm-hmm. To get back to the point on the compliance issue, as I understood your example from Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
that the real payoff was from people who simply hadn't filed, as opposed to people who had filed and were in arrears. Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, that was what the director in Hawaii told me, was that mm-hmm. they were getting returns from people they didn't even know were in the business of real estate. So I think it was more about getting a return.
Because the fact is that once someone's filed, you have other methods of collecting the money rather than, you know, other than through the licensing board, right?
Oh, Madam Chair, we have the a number of tools to collect dollars that are owed to us. That's absolutely true. One of the biggest challenges that we have is just knowing who should be filing. Mm-hmm. It's the people who should have filed a return and did not, and so they're not in our system in any way, particularly if they're not a wage earner and we're not seeing them in a data set from some other source. We have the ability to look for resources in financial institutions, take liens on real property. I mean, there are definitely ways that we can achieve collection. And as Deborah mentioned to you in her comments, usually once we've begun to connect with a taxpayer and there's an obligation and it's settled how much the obligation is, we try really hard to get people onto pay plans. where they agree, I can meet my obligation if you give me this amount of time. They sign an agreement, and they make monthly payments, and we give them coupons, and it's just processing payments.
Right.
And that's our preferred tool, and probably that's the dominant tool we use. That's the first thing that our agents are instructed to offer people is, if you can't pay it all at once, then how about over a short period of time? And we don't want to go to those more extreme measures because they are more costly to use, unless we absolutely have to.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Telfer.
So now I have to answer people, I think. What is the statutory ramification of not filing an Oregon tax return?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the penalty for failure to file a return is based on the amount of tax owed, and it depends on the period of time the failure exists. So, for example, if my return is due April 15th, 2009, and I don't file it until May, I pay 5% of the tax that I owed as a late filing penalty. If I don't file it until August or September or October, I'm more than 3 months late, there's an additional 20% added to that amount. If I don't file for 3 consecutive years, I have a 100% penalty, but all of those penalties are based on the tax owed. And if I don't owe any tax, I have no penalty, even if I'm 5 years late.
Oh, okay. And because of that, Oregon, unlike the IRS, who can throw you in jail if you don't file, we already have a penalty for somebody who doesn't file. Taking away their license doesn't necessarily... Let me back up then. What we're trying to do is set up a pilot to get people to file, not to have them lose their license because they didn't file. It's more of a data match. Well, we're not asking anybody to lose their license because they didn't file.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, our goal is to find as many tools that will encourage people to do the right thing under the law as we can find that are the most efficient tools that we can find. We currently have the authority, if we're unable to achieve collection or compliance from a taxpayer who does have a license, through any other means, which means the conversation we have, encouraging them to pay, offering them, you know, the choices for managing their payment, or trying to get them to file, and we're completely unsuccessful, there are no assets we can attach or anything else, at that point then we can go to a licensing board and we can ask for that board to suspend or revoke the license. They're entitled to a hearing on whether, in fact, they are not in compliance and the license should be suspended or revoked. So that's a tool that really is of last resort and we use very, very infrequently. In order for people to be able to pay a liability that they owe, they do need to have an income stream. And so it's in the state's best interest for them to be working with us, as Representative Reed commented. And the goal really of the pilot is to validate our belief based on what we hear from other agencies, other revenue agencies around the country, that having a requirement that a person be in compliance, at least filing compliance, in order to, as a condition of continuing to have the permission the state grants to engage in a particular trade or business, is a very effective inducement for people to step up and file, which is what they should be doing under the law in any event.
And that's different than revoking. I mean, if someone
that's
already
correct.
Has a license, that's one thing. But if they're asking for the privilege of getting a license, that's a little bit, I mean, I see that as a different kind of scenario.
Well, and Madam Chair, it would be either initial issuance or renewal.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. All right. Senator Morris.
Sorry for prolonging this, but I'm wondering if there's a nexus between this bill and our tax amnesty bill. And I'm wondering if you remove the word pilot and just said project, which would then allow you and your amnesty media to reference this as a way of making people that are not currently filing or have underfiled or have intentionally avoided through some whatever means that they might be encouraged to enlist the amnesty program.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, the way the bill is currently crafted, because it limits the number of licensing agencies that may participate to three, I don't know whether tying it to the amnesty is going to would achieve that result. Also, the amnesty will begin quickly enough that I'm not sure that we'll have all the bugs worked out of the licensing pilot in time to actually use that as one of the incentives.
I think Senator Morris was referring more to the fear factor,
mm-hmm. Right.
Where people, as part of the amnesty communication program, people can be informed that this program is going to be going into effect, either as a program or a pilot or whatever you want to call it. They don't know which agencies, but they do know, I mean, the information program would inform them that if they get past the amnesty program, their penalties go up. And mm-hmm. This would do nothing to that, correct?
That's correct.
So I think you're on to something, Senator Morris.
Well, Madam Chair, as a follow-up, it would change the complexion of the bill possibly more than the chief sponsor would want to take it, or maybe the assembly would want to take it, if you left it a more generic to, instead of a pilot project, it's a project, and you don't have a requirement or a minimum or a maximum with respect to the agencies, but that would be based on your determination by rule.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that's certainly the policy decision for the legislature, is what's the scope that you want this particular approach to have initially? Is it, do you want a pilot where we evaluate it thoroughly, come back and report, it's effective, it's not effective, or we need additional tools, or whether you just want us to go ahead and begin to implement a program? And that really, I think, where this bill went was the start with the baby steps approach, and then we'll report back in 2011, and the legislature then will decide, do you want to increase the scope. I think, given the fact that we didn't put a fiscal on it, it probably needs to remain fairly focused. And we do have a lot of just mechanical issues to make sure that we work out because of that, as I stated, that value we want to have of transparency and not holding up any otherwise compliant person. It should be just like not an issue for someone renewing a license if they're in compliance. It's only the people who are not that we then want to, hi, come talk to us. And this is going to take a little while to probably get going, because one of the things that we had in conversation with the House committee was to be sure that we are able to give a fairly long notice to any licensees that end up where their licensing agency participates with us in this project, that we want to be able to give a significant amount of notice so that for those people who know that they aren't in compliance, they have time to file and make arrangements well before their renewal dates come up.
Okay. Senator Hess?
Thank you. I was just going to note on Senator Morris's comment that the original bill was not a pilot project.
That's right.
It's been amended. The original bill was just a requirement. We need to just do this.
Any more questions? Thank you very much. We're going to take our next couple witnesses. I have to leave at a couple minutes after 2, so we'll try to move as quickly as we can through this. I'm going to take the Secretary of State folks, Will Garber and Jim Scott, and I can't tell whether Alice Bartelt is part of this. Okay, so let's bring Donna Maddox from the Justice Department up. Is it with these folks?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Will Garber. I'm Deputy Director at the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'd like to start by saying that we don't have a position on this bill, but I think we do have some information that could be useful for the committee as it considers the bill. By way of background, in March of this year, we began an audit to determine whether certain state data sources would be useful to the Department of Revenue in its efforts to try and identify individuals who do not file timely personal state income tax returns. And a little bit earlier during the survey phase of our audit, we'd had some discussions with the department about topics that could help them improve their performance. And this is one that came up that could help the department find and utilize resources to improve tax compliance. So we sort of saw this as a cooperative and collaborative effort to try and identify an audit topic of value. We're here today to talk to you briefly about a subset of this larger audit, and that's our analysis of data that we obtained from the Oregon Real Estate Agency. In summary, we do have sufficient reason to conclude that the department would benefit from using the real estate agency information to help identify potential non-filers. So I'd like to just give you a brief summary of the analysis that we did to get us to this conclusion. We began our analysis by matching data the real estate agency had on agents with an Oregon address and an active Oregon license in 2007. And we matched that with data the Department of Revenue had for people who filed personal income tax returns in 2007. And we used Social Security numbers as the common identifier to do that analysis. The match showed that about 9%, or nearly 1,500 of almost 16,000 people the real estate agency licensed in 2007, did not file a 2007 personal state income tax return. So we wanted to follow up on those results, so that we then randomly selected a sample of 40 potential non-filers to determine whether they really actually had a need to file. And we based that determination on gross income information that was reported to the Oregon Employment Department and the Internal Revenue Service. So we found that 68%, or 27 out of the sample of 40 that we chose, did indeed have a need to file because their gross income met or exceeded the state's filing thresholds. In addition, over half of those individuals also failed to file a return in 2006, even though they had gross income that exceeded the 2006 thresholds. Just a couple points I'd like to make about our methodology. First, we use filing thresholds for people that are 65 years of age and older. Those thresholds are higher than for younger individuals. And we also did not include partner income when we calculated gross income for joint filing. So in other words, we had income information from one of the two people who filed jointly that by itself exceeded the joint filing threshold. The other point I'd like to make is that we did not determine whether the 68 that should have filed actually had a tax liability. Our focus was just on whether they had a need to file. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take some questions.
That's a pretty stunning little presentation you just gave. So you were basically, what you're saying is you used very conservative thresholds.
Correct.
To determine whether. So it's entirely possible, for example, if someone was under 65, that you underestimated the people who needed to file.
That's true. Correct.
Question, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. So you mentioned you used Social Security numbers
match,
and obviously then the Board of Real Estate, whatever the regulatory body is called, provided you with Social Security numbers.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, that's correct.
Okay. And then what's the follow-up? Are we going to hear something about the follow-up from the Department of Justice, or did you just leave it, or what?
Well,
what
Madam Chair, I mentioned that this is part of a larger audit we're doing. We're considering some other state data sources, such as information from the Construction Contractors Board and from the Public Employees Retirement System. And what we'll do is complete our entire audit. It'll include these results, and that audit will have recommendations to the department in it.
And what is your timetable for completing that
audit? We're looking at completing the entire audit late this summer.
Okay. Thank you. Well, very interesting material. Questions before we move on? Who wants to go next?
Well, Jim's with me. Jim Scott
okay.
is with me.
Okay, for questions. Okay, let's hear from Justice.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Donna Maddox. I'm the attorney in charge of the organized crime section at the Oregon Department of Justice in the Criminal Division. The Department of Justice also does not have a position on this bill, but I was asked to come to talk a little bit about our experiences in the last few years doing criminal tax evasion cases in conjunction with the Department of Revenue, and how this sort of implicated by some of our work. I spent about 4 years working with the Department of Revenue and State Police in the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. Our job was to identify and investigate and prosecute folks that were engaged in criminal tobacco tax evasion. So not bad business folks who forgot, but people who were intentionally deceiving the department and coming up with schemes to evade taxes. What we found when we first started was very interesting. The law-abiding tobacco distributors who were trying to pay their taxes and abide by all the laws would frequently call us either anonymously on a tip line or would get in touch with us directly to say, hey, there's this guy down the street driving around in his truck and there's just no way, even though he has a license to distribute tobacco products, that he could possibly be doing this legitimately because he was able to undercut the legitimate sellers by such a great amount. And very often we would look into those cases and find, in fact, that while this person had been licensed by the state to be a distributor, they had not been filing either their tobacco taxes as owed or their personal or corporate income taxes if those were also implicated. We did find after we got to the point where we figured out that we could look not just at tobacco tax evasion but at personal and corporate income tax evasion as well, that folks that were licensed and cheated in one area, by and large, were cheating across the board in all areas. More recently, we were able to do what was a pilot project with the Department of Revenue to do some criminal income tax enforcement. We worked with Department of Revenue. They provided us with the person that they believed, based on their records, was probably the most egregious tax evader that they had identified, at least, in Oregon. We agreed to work that case in conjunction with them to see how it would work. This is not something we had typically done before. There are criminal penalties on Oregon statutes. We could put somebody in jail in Oregon. It would be a rare day where you would go to jail in Oregon for tax evasion because of the way the statutes are written, but it could happen. What we found when we started to investigate this individual was that he had used multiple names, multiple business entities over a series of about 6 years. He was operating as a subcontractor in the drywalling business. He had a license with CCB and had been licensed in about 4 different business names, using different variations of his name and other individuals' names to license with the Secretary of State's office and then to go and get licensed with the CCB. He had been consistently undercutting his competitors for years, had collected and not paid taxes through the business on about $25 million in a revenue stream over that time period. We were able to locate and investigate that individual, who is now serving about 60 months on a state racketeering and income tax evasion charge. The thing that was interesting is that, once again, he had been consistently over time, had gone in and reapplied for his CCB license and had been granted that because there wasn't a mechanism in place to check to see if he had been paying taxes. And then if he hadn't been paying taxes, to use that information to keep him from being relicensed.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I've had experience in my own business life competing with someone who got caught up in tax evasion. They weren't paying their taxes. And it's not fun when you're not playing on a level field. What you're saying just brought back memories of previous experiences that I've had.
Maybe it was the same dude. Did you have a question? All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is very enlightening. Committee, I need to leave, so we have 2 more witnesses, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Morse to finish this hearing, and then we will bring this bill back later. Thank you, Senator Morse.
We have a witness list.
Oh, I guess that would help.
We have... George Jody Weiser? Is Jody?
She
stepped out of the room. Alice Bartlett.
Bartel.
Bartel. I didn't get. Bartel. Okay. My fault.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alice Bartelt. I'm the co-chair of the Public Policy Committee of the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I've given you written testimony, and I won't repeat it, my main reason for testifying today is that we're looking for every dime we can find right now, and this seems like a reasonable bill to try to enforce the tax laws that we already have and to bring in some money that we desperately need.
Well, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Well, is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Representative Reed, do you have any thoughts on the amendments as the bill has amended versus its original version?
Mr. Chair, committee members, again, Tobias Reed. I think the testimony has really underscored the value of this approach, and I'm comfortable with the amended version. I think it's important to have something that will garner sufficient support in both houses and allow us to go down this road to figure out the most effective mechanisms that will work. I think, based on the anecdotal testimony we've heard today, there's a lot of fertile ground there, and it'd be my expectation that with the expert work of the department, we might be back here in 2011 talking about how we can expand the effort.
Was the testimony today new information?
I had not heard, Mr. Chair, from the Secretary of State's office before, so that was new to me. I had heard some of the other information.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This might be a dangerous question, but I'm just curious, were there arguments made against this on the House side?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I think generally people were concerned about, there's always danger for me too in putting words in other people's mouths, but I think people were concerned about getting the mechanism right so that it did not sweep up people who were otherwise trying to do the right thing. So we worked hard, and I should thank a number of people who were involved in making sure that we were dotting the right I's and crossing the right T's so that the mechanics of it work in the correct way. But I think generally once people understand the intent, we're not trying to stop someone who is trying to do the right thing, someone who is engaging in the appeal process or those sorts of things. We're not after those people. It's the people who are deliberately avoiding their obligations. I think most people are okay with it.
Thank you.
Yes,
did any of the regulatory bodies weigh in?
Those
that you would be piloting with, the department would be piling, potentials that they would be piloting with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Telfer, I didn't have any direct contact with those, and I think the bill would allow the department to figure out who is a willing partner amongst those licensing agencies, but I did not have any direct contact with them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. As a CPA, I think we're the only body that our license is tied to making sure that we're in compliance, meaning we have filed. It has nothing to do with liability of taxes owed once you filed, but and that's because we prepare tax returns. But I think most people I've talked to, the feeling is that the regulatory body is there for competency and regulating the industry, making sure that the consumer is protected because they're competent, et cetera, and then to just use them for the convenience of the Department of Revenue is a little bit far-reaching. So I do know that the Board of Accountancy has that requirement already. We have that nationwide that, CPAs need to make sure they're in compliance. We have to make sure all our staff are in compliance in order to keep our shingle hung. So I'm a little concerned about this far-reaching, using it at the convenience of the Department of Revenue to help them, except for when Senator Morris mentions that undercutting and because you're not paying taxes, you can gives me pause to think. So I'm a little
Mr. Chair, Senator,
torn on this one.
I appreciate the way you said that, particularly on the last point about the competitiveness, because I think that's an important point. I think the other thing is that we, as a state, have a stake in this when we are giving someone a license and saying, in essence, this person is competent. I think part of that competence is also that they're following the law and meeting their obligations to the state. So I think that's part of it.
It's a criminal violation.
Not in the state of Oregon.
If you don't pay taxes, it's not criminal?
Not in the state of Oregon.
If they put somebody in jail for 60 months, that had to be criminal.
Tax evasion, that was an IRS thing. I think Deborah said that it was penalties on taxes due. Granted, the DOJ said you could, in a very slim number of cases, you could put them in jail, but it's federal law that says it's tax evasion.
Chair Morris, Senator Telfer, we do have criminal tax evasion statutes in Oregon as well. So I believe it was under Oregon law that the example that Donna spoke to was that she was describing.
No, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Well, then I apologize because I thought when I asked you the question, you only told me that it was penalties on taxes due.
Chair Morris, Senator Telfer, and I should have elaborated that there are a number of provisions in Oregon law, and I was focused on the failure to file a return, not on tax evasion itself. I apologize.
So I guess my point would be valid, and Representative Reed's, that to be licensed, you want to be under the assumption that this person is, in fact, not violating criminal statutes or civil statutes, for that matter. So I just don't have much patience for somebody that isn't doing the right thing, and it causes me damage. Because we fought with this guy for a long time, you know, just undercutting us bid after bid after bid, and pretty soon it caught up to him. So, yes.
In response to that, Mr. Chair, I do see that being separate from not paying taxes. I mean, filing is one thing. In fact, if you're not going to pay, why even bother filing? I really can't imagine somebody's refusing to pay their taxes once they filed. But I'm concerned in this pilot that maybe we, you know, have some sort of line that says, okay, we're really focusing on those that haven't filed. But to actually threaten somebody with revocation of their license because they refuse to pay their tax, is there a criminal? Is that criminal? Since you have other methods of methodologies to collect that tax?
Chair Morris, Senator Telfer, I think I would go back to the existing law, which does authorize us to ask a licensing board or agency to start suspension proceedings if we have attempted to collect tax and have exhausted all means to collect that tax. Then we can start the license suspension proceedings under current law.
But you had deleted that out of the bill before it became a pilot.
Chair Morris, Senator Telfer, that is in current law, and this bill does not change that. That's a separate statute altogether.
Point of clarification. Let me just clarify what I was saying is that the original bill had that in there, and then there was an amendment that pulled it out, I believe so. But now this is a totally different bill. This is a pilot, not a.
Mr. Chair, Senator Telfer, perhaps I can elaborate on that a little bit. This may just be a function of timing. When I submitted the original request to get things started, I said what we're building from is the provision that was in 2592, I think it was, from 2007 that was removed on the Senate. In a quick description to the Legislative Council, that's the general basis of where we're starting, and then the amendments proceeded from there to try and address the concerns that we uncovered in trying to improve it. So that may be part of it.
And my error, I was thinking of a Senate bill that was the same, other than the fact it wasn't a pilot.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jody, did you wish to testify? You're certainly welcome to do so.
I don't even have a copy of
the testimony. We do.
Okay, well, you can read,
right? Yes, you can read.
For the record, Jody Weiser, Ashley. Mark had a bill with this kind of thing in it, and so did Greg McPherson in 2005. And licenses got pulled out of that bill, and it was in another bill in 2007, and licenses got pulled out of that bill, and so it's really nice to see this bill moving forward this year. It's the kind of thing that most taxpayers think is actually done. They assume it's done, and that's probably fortunate because then they're more apt to be honest on their taxes. But in the states that have instituted matching licenses with taxpayers, they find even accountants that are not. Even accountants.
Certified that, or those others?
The licensed ones. The ones that got licensed at the state that have figured out that the game can be played. Doctors, you know, manicurists, everything. And so, you know, it's common sense that we should verify. And it's a fairly simple way to do some of that. It's not extensive like the bill that's moving through the building Ways and Means right now. And it goes that more, much, much more deeply after the underground economy. But this should help. And I'm glad that it's before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Do we know the field of possibilities here in terms of licensees that potentially would be affected if this was just totally, if we implemented an ongoing program with all of the agencies that issue licenses? How many?
How many are there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's bills now to add licensing for other professions in the building. So I don't know. I don't have any idea how many different licenses there are.
The reason I ask that is we have one little indicator now from the Secretary of State's office that what the ratio was, 9%? Just in that one category. If you interpolated that or even something less than that over the broad range of licensees in this state, you're talking potentially a lot of evasion.
And a lot of people who get licenses are working in the part of the world where there isn't a W-2. I mean, teachers have licenses, and most of them are getting W-2s for the work they do. But manicurists don't get W-2s, and real estate people don't get W-2s. I mean, a lot of the licenses are in those kind of areas where you have a greater latitude in interpreting what your income for the year is.
Okay, thank you.
The comment on that is, and that's a step that I think the state should do, is the Department of Revenue no longer requires the employer to send a copy of the W-2 to them, so they really don't know whether a teacher is filing or not. I know we've had this conversation that they can get that information, but I remember the day when we did submit W-2s, 1099s, everything to the Department of Revenue, and we don't do that now, though they can access that.
People at the department can talk about in the old days if they were doing, answering phone calls and they didn't have calls, their job was to go through the box of W-2s and sort things and do that kind of verification, and now that it's not possible. And I think when there are a lot of people who know it's not possible, and that creates the knowledge that there's more opportunity there. I mean, you know, it just took a few people getting tickets between Portland and here on I-5 for everybody in the lobby room to know that you could get a ticket easily in the morning driving to the Capitol, and I bet you that is part of why the traffic slowed down there, you know. It helps. It helps to know there's a cop.
Okay. Hearing no request for more testimony or comment, the hearing on House Bill 3082 is closed and adjourned.
I think there's a possibility.